The way I would like to introduce deep brains is by analogy with sources in quantum field theory. So the prototypical example you should think about is studying QED plus one proton. Okay. So there is your QED action, and then there is an extra term, which is the integral over some trajectory that a proton decides to follow of the gauge field. So this describes the way electrons and photons would interact with some heavy particle of charge 1, which follows some trajectory, you know, very heavy, mass much larger than whatever energy scales we're looking at. And it might exchange photons with the rest of the universe. So introducing this source will give rise to new Feynman diagrams where some photons can end on the trajectory of the photon. These legs are different from the other external legs of the diagram because the other external legs go to infinity. Well, these ones are attached to a propagator. So in a Swinger, in a proper time realization of the propagator, this means that these trajectories have some specific proper time length over which we're integrating. So if you try to compute these Feynman diagrams in terms of proper times, there will be integral over the length of this segment, this segment, this segment. So in analogy, in order to introduce deep brains, let's say one deep brain in string theory, we should allow ourselves to look at worksheets where some tubes, some external legs come from infinity, but other ones end at some finite distance from the worksheet. So here we need to somehow put something that, you know, some prescription on how the worksheet can end. Let me denote this prescription with some symbol. B1. B1 will be our first, you know, one choice of prescription on how the worksheet can end. Once I allow myself to have this sort of ends, I can have all sorts of processes, right, which involve that kind of end. So the string perturbation theory will look like this now. We will have both a sum over the number of tubes in your worksheet and a sum over the number of boundaries and then some amplitude computed as some integral over some space or Riemann surfaces which have both a certain genus and a number of punctures and a certain number of boundaries. And this amplitude will depend on the specific choice of boundaries conditions that we are imposing, on the specific rules we have set here. And then we can put a part of the coupling, which one can argue should be something like this. I can motivate this later, but let me just put that power. Now, in the same way as in QD, I could introduce multiple protons, maybe a proton, a pion, whatever. The same way here, I could allow myself multiple possible ways for the worksheet to end at finite distance. If I do that, then I have to sum over all the choices of boundary conditions too. All the choices of deep brains, meaning that each of these boundaries might correspond to deep brain number one, deep brain number two, deep brain number three. So for each of the boundaries, we have to choose which of my collection of allowed deep brains this tube is ending on. So this will be more or less how can I start setting up perturbation theory in the presence of these sources. Now, of course, we'll have to understand precisely how to make this work in the sense of understanding how gauge freedom that we have, gauge fixing matrix in the presence of a boundary. Mm-hmm.
When we first introduced the deep brains, we're talking about the boundary of open worksheet, so we're talking about...
I've not mentioned open worksheet yet.
Okay.
But I'll do it in a second. Okay. So for now, I just say, okay, I want some of these tubes to end somewhere. Now, it is true that once you introduce these boundaries, a whole lot of other things happen. Because if you look at a surface like this, and you look at all possible matrix you can put on it, you will find maybe processes that might be more effectively described in a way that I cannot draw. Sorry. I'm always wondering how to describe properly a tube with a hole. So you can have processes so the hole starts getting pretty big. And if you think about something propagating through space-time, at some point this starts looking like an open string rather than a closed string. So if you look, as we start doing calculations in here, I don't think we'll get to do any calculations, but if you were doing some calculations in the context with deep brains, we would find that our scattering amplitudes have poles that correspond to the propagation of states at intermediate legs, which are not in the closed string spectrum. And if you try to understand geometrically what they mean, it's just the fact that once you allow your worksheet to end on some boundary, you must consider a situation where you have an open string which ends on these boundaries. So even if you just start by a scattering theory with closed strings that bounce off these sources, unitarity of this matrix tells you that you also have to include the possibility now of open strings, sort of attached to these sources. Now, the fact of having degrees of freedom attached to a source is not by itself perhaps surprising. For example, if you wanted to study a proton which has a finite mass, you might want to include the position of the proton as your degrees of freedom. That would be a degree of freedom that lives on the proton. Or suppose that instead of a proton, I'm looking at the membrane, the membrane of a drum interacting with some particles. A particle might hit the membrane and get absorbed, excite a vibration of the membrane, which then spits out a particle again. So you will have processes which involve some degrees of freedom living on your source, potentially. if you're looking at theory of gravity, a proton cannot be infinitely massive. It will have to have a finite mass. It will have to be able to recoil in order to conserve energy and momentum. So the fact that you have to typically put degrees of freedom on sources in theories which have gravity is not surprising. The surprising fact is that string theory puts them there by itself. So you don't have to add new degrees of freedom. You're just studying the same worksheet theory. But the excitations it produces are both closed strings and open strings. Okay, now, when you try to repeat all we did for closed worksheets, for worksheets with boundaries, you again need to have some path integral over metrics with some symmetries, and you need to make sure that your setup preserves some diffeomorphism and violin invariance. So you might ask yourself, what are the conditions for a boundary at finite distance in a quantum field theory to preserve violin invariance and diffeomorphism invariance? So it turns out that the condition can be expressed in the following way. Suppose I have a boundary. I take my stress tensor. So we already know that to have bulk vial symmetry in the bulk, the stress tensor must be traceless. And now I'm going to add a new condition. I'm going to ask what happens when the stress tensor is brought to the boundary. And so the condition for vial invariant turns out to be that if you take the component of the stress tensor with one leg perpendicular to the boundary and one leg parallel to the boundary, and you bring it to the boundary, this must vanish. I will not be able to prove this to you. It takes a little bit of work. It's sort of a slightly stronger condition than energy conservation. See, you could have asked a weaker condition. You could ask, how do I describe in a quantum field theory a boundary condition which preserves energy conservation, that doesn't break energy momentum conservation? So the condition would be that whatever energy momentum flowing to the boundary should be accounted for by some amount of some change in the energy momentum in the energy carried by the boundary. Yeah, the boundary cannot really carry momentum, but can carry energy. And if you want energy conservation to hold in the presence of the boundary, you want to be able to make sure that whatever energy flows into the boundary is kept track of. That would mean that, so in general, energy conservation means that T perpendicular parallel. See, this is the amount of energy which is flowing into the boundary. At the boundary should be the time derivative of some and sort of boundary stress tensor, something that measures amount of energy at the boundary. Remember, this is the direction parallel to the boundary, this is the direction perpendicular to the boundary. So this is the condition in general for energy conservation. In order to have a boundary, in the same way as the conservation of the stress tensor is automatic in a theory of gravity, if you want a theory, if you want to be able to couple the quantum field theory with a boundary to a metric in a reasonable way, you will get some condition like this. But this follows from diffeomorphism invariance in the presence of the boundary. Then vial symmetry somehow tells you that this has to actually vanish, that the boundary cannot carry energy by itself. Now this might look,
So is that related to the scale current in the bar energy, this little t? Because that's the same thing that we have scale of conformal
domain. Yeah, no, that's right. So this follows from van invariance. I'm not sure that scale invariance alone is enough to set this to zero. I don't quite remember.
Right. I mean, I suspect, I mean, what I noticed that on top of van invariance, you need, on top of scale invariance, you need van invariance to set the scale current to be congruent.
Yes, but we just have we have van invariance right away. We
right.
just talk about string theory, we need van invariance.
Is a small t also supposed to be a tensor in all of that?
Well, yes, I should have written like that, sorry. In general, so for I could have written this in any number of dimensions, then this would have been a bunch of parallel indices. So there would be just one perpendicular direction to your boundary and many possible parallel directions. And the equation would look like t perpendicular I at the boundary equal dj tij. That's right. So, yeah, I'm making it more complicated than it actually is. It just, if you know, in the same way as the stress tensor in the bulk is traceless, you want the boundary one to be traceless, and the trace of the boundary one is just T itself. But actually, in higher dimension, I'm pretty sure that the actual condition is that T itself. There is a further distinction of what happens depending on the theory being unitary or not. So I think that in Hager dimension, if you have boundary condition in a theory which are not unitary, it might be okay to have something like this with this being traceless. I don't quite remember, but it's probably the case. Then if you also impose unitarity, there is a calculation one can do to show that if you have something like this, then these two parts will vanish separately. But that really would bring us beyond the scope of this. It's just that in unitary conformal field theories, operators which have a certain special dimension, you know, operators with spin which have a certain special dimension, satisfy conservation laws automatically. It's completely analogous to the sort of calculations we did at some point. Suppose I have some vector and I compute L minus 1, the absolute value of L minus 1 of that vector. This is proportional to the dimension of that vector. In a unitary theory, this left-hand side should be positive, so the dimension will be positive, or zero. It can be zero only if this actually vanishes. So in two-dimensional conformal field theory, whenever you have a state which vanishes, whose dimension vanishes, is killed by L minus 1. If you go from states to operators, it means whenever you have an operator of dimension zero, its derivative vanishes. So it's actually the identity. So in the conformal field theory, unitary conformal field theory, in two dimensions, the only operators dimension zero are multiples of the identity. In the same way, if you look at operators with spin in some generic dimension, you find that if their dimension equals their spin, then they satisfy some derivative equal to zero. So this is a bringing us out of on a tangent. So for today, I only need this statement that a boundary condition is valid invariant if this holds. So so in the full BRST formalism, this condition is augmented by conditions on the ghosts. For example, the presence of a boundary gauge the homomorphisms, the gauge symmetries will leave this picture invariant, and transformations will leave the boundary fixed. So vector fields, which was component perpendicular to the boundary, vanishes at the boundary. So correspondingly, we will want our ghosts to perpendicular, the component of the C ghost perpendicular to the boundary to vanish. We want T for the matter fields perpendicular parallel to vanish, and we want B correspondingly perpendicular parallel to vanish. These are the kind of boundary conditions you naturally use for defining D-brains. And these conditions do imply that BRST symmetry is preserved. Very concretely, a symmetry is preserved by a boundary whenever the perpendicular component of the current at the boundary vanishes or is a total derivative. If you write down the BRST current, which has things like CA, TAB, plus some C, CB, CB, and some B, C, the C sort of thing, if you plug these conditions in the BRST current and you check what happens at the boundary, you'll find that the perpendicular component vanishes, so the BRST symmetry is preserved. And nilpotent. Okay. So these are sort of the general conditions we need. And now I would like to specialize these general conditions to the specific case at hand, which is, say, bosonic string moving in flat space. Now, perhaps I should say a couple more words. So, unfortunately, this is probably the first time you guys encounter a quantum field theory with a boundary. Quantum field theory with a boundary. In general, textbooks are not very concerned with boundaries and other kind of lower codimension defects in quantum field theory, which is a bit because it's actually quite an interesting and rich subject. Typically, for a lot of theoretical physicists, the first time boundaries are encountered is precisely when studying D-brains, which is kind of funny. So there are some implicit assumptions here that are going on that are probably not obvious at all at first sight. Even the notion of a boundary in quantum field theory as opposed to a state might be confusing. You know, what's the difference in saying that I insert a state at the end of a semi-infinite tube or that I put a boundary at the end of a tube of finite length? Is there any difference? Can I just put any state here and call it a boundary? How do you precisely describe the difference between the two? Now, it's perfectly true that boundaries give you states. See, if I take a geometry, which is a cylinder, a half cylinder, and I put a boundary at time zero, this will create a state for my theory in the cylinder. It's called the boundary state. So there's definitely a map from boundaries to states. But not all states come from a boundary, from a local boundary condition. Local is the crucial word here. So a local boundary condition is a boundary condition which sort of preserves the same type of locality which you encounter in the bulk. In the presence of a local boundary, you can ask questions about local operators in the bulk, local operators at the boundary. And but correlation functions only diverge when things come close to each other. Your stress tensor is still well defined when you bring it to the boundary, and so on and so forth. Or it has a specific behavior when you bring it to the boundary, and so on and so forth. So there is a whole bunch of implicit locality assumptions when you talk about a boundary. See here, for example, when I wrote down this equation, right, I wrote this equation as some condition that holds at each individual point on the boundary. And same here. So if you want a way to think about local boundary conditions is that they impose that whatever constraints they impose on the fields are local constraints. You're not going to say, okay, the field here equals twice the field over there. That would be a non-local condition. Most states impose non-local relationships between fields at different parts of your boundary. For example, the vacuum, right? The vacuum puts all the Fourier modes in their ground state. This is a very non-local statement. If you try to write down the wave function for the vacuum, it definitely mixes up the fields all over the circle. Okay. So here, perhaps you should say that you might ask, why did you decide to put local sources here? Why didn't we try to do something more local on the worksheet? Of course, the glib answer is because it works, but perhaps something better is deserved. I'm not sure I know precisely what the correct answer is here. Although probably the fact that you're trying to have this setup coupled to a two-dimensional metric helps a lot. And to have diffeomorphism invariance. Yes?
So what would the no boundary proposal count as to you? The state described by like the Hartle-Hawking-like state, maybe 2D quantum gravity. If
you're familiar with it. I'm not sure what.
So
what direct connection to this?
Say, for instance, that there's no boundary that you're dealing with.
Okay, but there is a boundary.
No, but I mean, would that count as something that's local or not?
That would just be saying the cylinder ends.
Right.
So there would be no boundary.
Right.
There would be just any part completely identical to any other part of the worksheet.
It's just like the bulk.
Yes. Okay. But anyway, so this will be my prescription for now for D-brains. I will add these local boundary conditions, these local boundaries to the worksheet. Okay. Right, so I was saying one of the things these boundaries do is they create states, which are sort of the sources. And the other thing that you can do with boundaries is that you can consider geometries which are not a cylinder, but a strip. Putting boundaries a sigma equal to 0 and a sigma equal to pi. And then asking what's the Hilbert space of your theory in this configuration. So what is these are the things I would like to do today. Find some simple boundary conditions and show you how to compute this and this.
Does it have to be the same?
they are completely unrelated. There are relations between them, because I can try to do calculations on an annulus. So I can say, let me compute a partition function on an annulus. This can be done in two ways. I can take this state, evolve it for some time, and contract it at another state. But I can also treat this direction as Euclidean time and say this is a trace over this Hilbert space of e to the minus, actually 1 over L and the energy. Checking that these expressions are the same definitely puts a non-trivial constraint on the situation.
So the Hamiltonians will be different.
Yes, that's right. So this is E closed and this is E open. And another thing that you can see from here that is kind of interesting, this calculation does not have a natural rescaling. Now, if your energy is well, if you have a well-defined definition of your energy, this is just what it is. You don't get twice this. But maybe you can get twice this if you double up your Hilbert space. But you cannot, there is no calculation which gives you this times pi, times e, times one third, you know, square root of 2. Now you compare it to this, that means that somehow this boundary state has some canonical normalization. You can take a boundary state, maybe you can get twice the boundary state if you literally take two sectors in your, you know, two copies of the Hilbert space, but you cannot get pi times this. So the sources that we are adding are somehow intrinsically quantized. Which is a bit funny. It's like saying that in a theory of gravity, the mass of these sources we're adding can only be an integral multiple of some amount, of certain amounts. But anyway. Okay, so I want to, before I run out of time, I want to get to actually do a calculation. So now, if I want to describe, if I consider a theory of, you know, 26 scalar fields, there are many, many different ways to make the stress tensor component vanish. They're actually very interesting. I'll look at them. But for now, let me just focus on a single scalar field. Let me, for simplicity, look at boundary conditions which I can impose separately on each scalar field, sort of mixing them up. Well, then the stress tensor for a single scalar field is essentially this. So requiring this component, this product to vanish the boundary, I can do it in two ways. Either this vanishes or this vanishes. So the first choice is called Neumann boundary conditions. Tells you the perpendicular component of the scalar field vanishes at the boundary. The second possibility is called Dirichlet. It tells you that the parallel component of the field at the boundary vanishes, which can also be expressed as saying that the field itself at the boundary equals some constant some fixed value. This is slightly stronger than this because you could have said that it had, no, it's not such thing. So I think to define the local boundary condition, you need to actually specify precisely what is this value. Actually. So intuitively, this means the string can end wherever it wants in this direction, or the string can only end at this specific location. So by combining normal boundary and Dirichlet boundary conditions for the various scalar fields in spacetime, you can get boundary conditions where the string can end on some hyperplane. These hyperplanes, these extended objects, are what's usually called D-brains, more concretely. Typically, you would say you would call it the zero brain, some boundary condition where the string has to end at some specific point in space. You usually let them extend in time to have energy conservation. A D1 brain would be a situation where the string can end on a line in space, and so on, all the way to D25 brains. So we need to do two calculations, as I said. I want to compute the boundary state, and I want to compute the Hilbert spaces. Now, for computing the boundary state, I should still look at the expansion on the... It's a cylinder calculation. So I still need to use the usual expansion of the scalar field. So normal boundary conditions impose that tau equal to zero. We'll ask the time derivative to vanish. So when you impose it, this pulls down the same overall factor. And the condition for Neumann is that looks like this. So these are essentially, I just expanded in Fourier mode the condition the normal boundary conditions. So the boundary state for normal boundary condition looks like this. You can see that this solves these equations. The only thing I want you to carry out of this calculation is that the boundary states contain all sorts of string modes. There are superposition of states with arbitrary number of oscillators. So these D-brains will source tachyon, graviton, and all the infinite power of string modes in a very specific pattern. Now, if you do the same calculation for the Dirichlet boundary condition, now the Dirichlet boundary condition don't set the momentum to zero anymore. Instead, they try to set the position to zero. And impose the opposite relationship between the left and right movers. So it looks like this. So you see these source, these are like a localized source. This was a smeared source. Makes sense. Now, to do the other calculation, we need to consider the strip. So let me start with Neumann-Neumann. So now we need to expand our scalar field in Fourier modes on the strip, imposing boundary conditions that tell you that the space derivative of the scalar field should vanish here and here. You can imagine expanding it into cosines, say. Indeed, the expansion looks as follows. Just a glorified cosine. So what do we see? Well, because our boundary conditions are not restricting the endpoints to any location, I still have a freedom to for the center of mass. There is still a center of mass mode. On the other hand, I got half as many oscillators. So the two towers of oscillators, not I guess just get one type of oscillators. So the Hilbert space for normal boundary conditions consists of a bunch of states with some momentum. And things built on them with one sequence of oscillators. The stress tensor also has a similar expansion in cosines involving only one set of oscillators. So there is a single copy of the Virasoro algebra now in this open string sector, which have the same the usual expression. In particular, there is some L0, which is up to some slight changes in normalization. So that now L0 is 2 pi squared. In this normalization. Okay. And then there is a similar story for the ghosts. There is again a ghost ground state, and then one single copy of all the oscillators. Okay. So what's the string spectrum? What's the open string spectrum? Well, this is now going to give us a tachyon again, an open string tachyon. With mass squared minus 1/2. And then to the next level, we'll find something fun. A massless particle. OK, so here I'm putting just one copy. Sorry, I want to do this properly. Right. Suppose that when I'm discussing the string spectrum, suppose that, for example, I got 26 fields with all with Neumann boundary conditions. OK? So let me talk about the D25 brains for now. Then I will start putting Dirichlet boundary conditions. So there is a massless field, which is going to have one Lorentz index,
photon.
A photon. That's right. So there is a photon living on the D25 brain. I mean, adding the D25 brain has added a photon to the theory. If you check what are the things these photons interact with, you'll find that they are the endpoints of the strings. So the endpoints of strings behave like particles. This photon just carries, measures the charge carried by these particles. It's a bit analogous to the B field that we found in the closed sector graphs, which was carrying a charge carried by the whole strings. Now, next, we can look at directions which have Dirichlet boundary conditions. But first, do you have any questions about that sort of calculation? It is really not any harder than the closed string calculation. It's actually easier because you have only one set of oscillator. And for perverse didactical reasons, people often introduce open strings before they introduce closed strings, precisely because calculations are a little bit easier. For example, it's very straightforward to do a calculation of a scattering amplitude of 4 tachyons, open string tachyons. It gives what's something called the Virasoro amplitude, which is a simpler version of the Virasoro-Shapiro as we saw for closed strings. Another thing I can say is that this open string tachyon is a little bit less mysterious than the closed string tachyon. The closed string tachyon describes some sort of process which destroys space-time, and we don't understand where it ends. The open string tachyon just destroys the brain. So it's actually possible to really show concretely that if you let the open string tachyon get an expectation value, the brain starts disappearing from there. The end point of the tachyon decay is just that the brain is not there anymore. Now, when you do calculations with Dirichlet boundary conditions, your scalar field is expanded like this in signs of the position. But right, the bigger difference here is that now there is no momentum, zero mode anymore. No momentum, no zero mode. So the Hilbert space only contains some vacuum and the usual things built out of the vacuum. So if you take this calculation and replace some of the directions with Dirichlet directions, so if you look at the BP brain, which has, say, X0 to XP Neumann and XP plus 1 to X25 Dirichlet. Now you have modes which carry momentum, but only in these P directions. But the massless modes now can, let me call these indices I and these indices A's. To distinguish them. But the massless modes now have both things which are polarized along the brain and things that are polarized perpendicular to the brain. On the other hand, the gauge symmetry only involves derivatives along the brain. So this gives you still a photon on your p-dimensional object. But this is another massless field. This massless field is actually interpreted as transverse fluctuations.
transverse motion. So this open string mode just describes the fact that this DP brain can move. You can really check that if you sort of exponentiate, if you put a coherent state of this, it changes the shape of the brain. It changes the boundary condition from x close to constant to x equal to some other function of the Neumann directions. So this is the first direct hint that these brains are dynamical. Indeed, now you can try to sort of repeat the kind of analysis we did for to find the closed string effective action.
So, Professor, on the deep brains, the dynamics of the deep brains, so there is a spectrum on like the tangent of the brains, and there is over.
So there is a gauge field which lives on the brain. So it has indices along the direction of this object.
And there is
field. So if the brain is three-dimensional, there is a three-dimensional gauge field sitting there. On the other hand, there are 26 minus 3 other massless fields which describe transverse fluctuations. Now, the deep brain is free to move, so these fields are massless. I mean, if you just think about whenever you have an extended object in flat space, it comes with massless modes to describe the fluctuations of the object. Is pretty much a consequence of the Goldstein theorem. If I put an object here, it's breaking translation symmetry. So it should have modes, massless modes, which represent the action of the symmetry group on the object. I'm not sure you've seen the Goldstein theorem, so this statement was probably almost useless. Oh, you saw it? Excellent. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So if you go to the target space picture, then is this extended object not back reacting or something? Because presumably.
No, that's right. So, right, good. Good. I should have been more precise. So if I have a quantum field theory, say, and I put a hard boundary, some external thing that I'm putting there by hand, that thing does not need to have any degrees of freedom describing its movement. But if I have a soliton, like a domain wall between air and water, something that dynamically is created, then that has to have these sort of massless degrees of freedom, this kind of motion of the interface, because of the Goldstein theorem. So the fact that you have these degrees of freedom on the brain suggests that thinking about it as an external probe was not quite right. This thing that we are treating as an external probe is really trying to be a soliton, some dynamical lump of the made of the fields of the string. It back reacts in the sense that it sources closed strings, in particular it sources graviton, and it also has dynamics. Now, if you try to ask, now because it back reacts, you can check things like what's the mass or what's the tension of this object. Once you convince yourself of the powers of G string that I put up there, you can argue that, for example, a point like D brain will have a mass of order 1 over G string. So this is a posterior is the explanation why can we treat it initially as an external source. It's because in perturbation theory, it's infinitely massive at the leading order in perturbation theory, because the mass goes like 1 over G string.
Then as you start doing perturbation theory, the mass becomes finite but very large. And then you have this slow degrees of freedom describing the motion of this very ponderous object. Now, as you increase the string coupling, these masses start going down. So if you try to, if you have any reason to believe that the string theory has a meaning beyond perturbation theory, these D-brains must become dynamical objects on the same footing as the strings themselves. And indeed, some of the most fun dualities of string theory happen when you can interchange the role of D-brains and strings. Or we can, you can start looking at the D-brains as important as the strings. From this point of view, the fact that string theory is a string theory is an accident. It's just that there was a region of parameter space where this dilaton was very small. And in that region, the string, there are some string-like objects which are much lighter than all the other objects in your theory. But generically, in parameter space, string theory does not behave like a theory of just strings. There is all sorts of stuff. Now, right, so there are two things I want to do in the next 15 minutes. Let's say at least one and a half thing. So, suppose I was looking for more creative ways to make that component of the stress tensor, or the stress tensor vanish for a bunch of scalar fields. So now I'm trying to impose something like the perpendicular x mu, the parallel x mu equal to zero when restricted to the boundary. So, so these are two, you can think about two vectors in space-time. I want to impose them to be perpendicular to each other. So suppose that I say that my boundary condition restricts the endpoints of the strings to some submanifold X, some submanifold M inside R26 or 25,1. Okay? So I say X at the boundary must belong to M. Okay. Now this in particular tells you that the parallel, the derivative of X along the boundary must belong to the tangent space at that point. So if you want, if this manifold has p direction, p dimensions, I roughly get, a Dirichlet boundary condition in the 25, 26 minus p directions. In the remaining directions, I can do something similar to Neumann in the sense that, okay, I could do one naive thing and a slightly more complicated thing. The naive thing would be to say, okay, if this belongs to the tangent, the simplest way to make sure that this is orthogonal to this is to make sense to, is to say that this belongs to the normal. Direction. A slightly more refined way is to say that you can allow yourself to correct these by a vector in here, which is orthogonal to that. This can be done by adding something like like this. This condition will still allow this to be orthogonal to this, and will give you a stress tensor which classically has satisfied the current boundary conditions. So which degrees of freedom do we have here? Sorry, this works if this is anti-symmetric in mu and nu, so that when you contract these with these, you get a term which, where this is contract, where this all, when with this is contracted. Okay, let me compute it. Now I get so I get something like that, but if this is anti-symmetric, this vanishes. So what are the degrees of freedom that we see here? What are the parameters, right, in this construction? The parameters are the shape of M and this anti-symmetric field strength. I call it field strength. Why? Because, see, these two parameters are clearly very closely related to the massless degrees of freedom that we encountered here. These describe small fluctuations of the choice of shape. This photon is just a small fluctuation in the choice of, this is just the field strength of the photon. Now, of course, you can ask, does this vanish quantum mechanically too? These are, big, complicated nonlinear boundary conditions, so you should treat them in perturbation theory, do your usual analysis, and you get some beta functions for the shape of M and for this F. These beta functions will come from some action, some effective action, which is going to be the low energy effective action for the photon and for the shape. Something called the DBI action. Mm-hmm.
So by shape, do you mean in the value space that encodes the extrinsic curvature?
I mean the shape. So concretely, what you can do is to pick some local coordinates on your D-brain and encode the shape of the D-brain into some fields. And then there will be the fields. Okay, let me just ignore the field, the gauge field for now. And then the DBI action turns out to be pretty much what you would expect, square root of the determinant at the leading order. Square root of the determinant of del z over del u a the action for this D-brain at the leading order is just the volume of the D-brain itself. Again, it's almost unavoidable by just, it's just going to, what happened, it's going to happen for any kind of solitonic object which moves in a theory of gravity is going to have an action like that at the leading order, plus corrections, which are controlled by the curvature, both extrinsic and intrinsic. Again, it's just, there is some souped-up version of the Gaussian theorem that people know how to use to argue for things like this. Okay, so there's the first statement, that you can study boundary conditions and their RG flow and their beta functions in the same way as you study quantum field theories themselves, and these beta functions will give you the equations of motion for the open string fields. The second fact I want to stress is, brings me back to this statement that I just erased, of course. So, sorry. So to the statement that you cannot just multiply a boundary state by whatever you want but you can take multiple copies of the open strings. So more precisely, what you can do is when you define your amplitude up there, you could have taken B2 to be the same as B1, but still count it multiple times. So you could have multiple D brains which are sitting at the same place. Okay. Or not necessarily, in general, you can have multiple. Before I go there, just you can have multiple D brains. When you have multiple D brains, what open strings are you going to get? Well, of course you're gonna get open strings attached to a specific brain. But more generally, you're getting open strings attached to multiple brains. If I have a brain here and a brain here, I have strings, I might have strings stretched between them. Now that's really counterintuitive. It's kind of okay to think that, okay, I put a soliton there, it's natural to have degrees of freedom attached to the soliton. But the fact that when I put two solitons, I get four new sectors. That's really counterintuitive. Especially if the brains are identical. So if I have n copies of the same brain, it means that all of these fields come in n square copies. So if I have n DP brains, now I have n times n objects of this form. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So one end at end point at one the brain, yes. Another one in another D brain.
That's right.
So they should have N DD or whatever DN. I mean the boundary conditions.
I'm saying suppose I take n copies of a specific boundary condition, then I have n square copies of the Hilbert space of open strings. Neither you say, okay, I have n squared photons. Not quite. What you have is n squared gluons. So one of the most beautiful magics is that these open string fields really behave like matrices. And their action involves matrix multiplication. And there are interactions. So there are sort of, yeah, okay. Let me just, I have 5 minutes, so I want to say it concisely. So the first thing there is this beautiful fact that if you have n DP brains, for volume theory is not n square photons, is n square gluons. So it's a UN gauge theory. So somehow, when your D brains are indistinguishable in a very deep way, there is a gauge symmetry which rotates among themselves the different ways the open string can end. Sorry, I want to say properly. So the analogy is that the endpoint of a string behaves like a quark. It has n colors, and it could be ending on string one, on D brain one, D brain two, D brain three, D brain four. But its color is a gauge symmetry.
So would the Goldstone theorem include all the copies? Like, could I
have? Oh, this goes way beyond the Goldstone theorem. So there are not only n squared copies of the gauge fields, there are also n squared copies of the transfer positions.
Exactly.
What does it mean? It makes no sense. Well, if you look at the action for this, so it's true that they look massless. So if I think about them as fields, I can call them Z, as matrices. And I look at their action in space-time, there is, of course, something like this. So they look like massless fields. But then when you go look at the interactions, they have interactions that look like this. This is actually completely analogous to the interactions which appear for these gauge fields. You know, a non-abelian gauge theory is different from a theory of n-squared photons because it has interactions that involves commutators squared. The scalar fields that describe the transfer position also have this kind of interaction involving commutators squared. So what does this interaction mean? It means that if you want to give an expectation value to this position, to these fields, they must be matrices which commute with each other, because the potential has to vanish. If I have a bunch of commuting matrices, I can diagonalize them. In particular, there is a gauge symmetry, so I can definitely diagonalize them. I can use my gauge symmetry to go in a gauge where they are diagonal. And then the eigenvalues describe the position of n drains. So you know, if you look at the truly massless directions, they are still n. But the dynamics get much richer when these d-brains come close to each other. You get to non-abelian gauge theory. And fields which carry these non-abelian degrees of freedom. So this is a very pleasant surprise, because it means that in string theory you find two of the most fun things in quantum field theory. You find gravity from the closed strings, and you find non-abelian gauge theory from the open strings. Okay, so this is unfortunately all we can say, all I'd be able to say about d-brains. I can add perhaps just one word because we have 30 seconds, so that here these d-brains are something I added to the closed string theory. So you can say, okay, there is a theory of closed strings, or there is a theory of closed strings with plus one brain, or a theory of closed strings plus two brains, and so on and so forth. Except that once they become dynamical, it's clear that it can also appear and disappear. So once you allow yourself d-brains, to say that there is one d-brain or two d-brains, it's kind of meaningless. You know, if I have a d-brain that moves in space-time, up and down in time, it might look like three d-brains, right? So they become like particles. The particle number is not necessarily a fixed amount. But not only that, you can find evidence that the theory of closed strings by itself would have trouble if you didn't include the possibility of having d-brains. So this goes quite far from whatever we can compute here, but there are some situations where you can push the closed string theory to the place where it starts breaking down. And this does not happen if you allow d-brains. For example, you can find situations where the closed string theory effective action would have a singularity as a function of the shape of a manifold or something like that. And you look at what that singularity looks like, and you find that it's just the singularity you would find if you had integrated away some light degrees of freedom, secretly. And those light degrees of freedom turn out to be the d-brains. So, meaning, you'll find that, right, because I said these d-brains are very heavy, right? But if I have an extended brain, they have a heavy tension. Now, if I have a heavy tension object which is wrapping some very tiny cycle in space-time, it might have a light, a small mass, because the mass is the tension times the area. So you can try to push string theory to places where the space-time has some cycles which are becoming very small. And you'll find singularities in your effective action. But at the same time, if you allow deep brains, there will be deep brains which are becoming very light. And the singularities in effective action are just the ones that will come out from integrating away states that are too light. So low energy effective actions are good and smooth as long as you're integrating away things that you could integrate away. If you try to integrate away a light particle, you'll find singularities, you'll find trouble. So, for example, if you have two scalar fields in your theory, one is light, the other is massive, but they must depend on the first scalar. And you integrate away the second scalar field, you'll get an effective action for the first scalar field, which goes singular in the places where the second scalar field becomes light. So you can find evidence scattered around closed string theory that open string, that deep brains really should be there. And that the only consistent thing is to have a theory of open and closed strings, allowing yourself all possible deep brains. Okay, that's it. Any questions?
Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to have UN cross UN minus one, some kind of gauge theory, what would that correspond to in terms of brains?
Well, you could have N deep brains close to M, N minus one deep brains of some other type.
Oh, I
see. Then each of these two stacks of deep brains would have their own non-abelian gauge symmetry. And then there will be open string stretched between them, which transform in the bifundamental of these two gauge groups, which have one leg rotated by one gauge group and another leg rotated by another. Okay. So from tomorrow we start superstring theory.